One O.
This is probably you. That's her.
Mike. You sure? I thought I was saying Mike that way. Yeah, mine's on right.
That's your word. Speak.
Hello.
To be mute.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, can I be heard from here? Yes. I don't have to crouch over the thing. We're on. Good evening. This is the November meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Health Commission. And the first order of business tonight is the approval of the minutes of the last meeting. Are there any changes or corrections to the minutes? Commissioner Hetherington?
Thank you. I think on page 6 at the top where it says Commissioner Discussion, I think it would probably be good if we expressed, well, never mind, it's over in the side, I missed it. I just wanted it spelled out that we were looking for a biomedical research scientist, a bioethicist, and a public health trained professional, and it's in there. Thank you, Jean. Sorry, I missed it.
I have a quick correction.
Okay.
On the last page, page 7, under Health Commissioner Update section, under Commissioner Donnelly, the second sentence mm-hmm. there should read, she will give a report after she attends their next meeting. That's it.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Donnelly. Any other?
Move to be approved.
Do we have a second?
As corrected.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the minutes will stand as corrected. Next item on the agenda is the public comment period. Anybody desiring to speak on a subject other than what is scheduled on the agenda?
And I am Eric Greening, and the topic is agenda posting. It used to be that when you were meeting in the library, we could always find the agendas on the Palm Street side of the old county government center 72 hours in advance. But given that, number one, there was nothing posted that I could find on the health department website when I clicked minutes or agendas as late as last night, and number two, that I have not geographically found the location where you do the physical posting, I think that's something that needs attention because the Brown Act does require 72-hour notification, and I think it would be good if you could tell the public what is the geographical place one finds the agenda posted. There is certainly space by the Monterey Street entrance here. There's two big glass-fronted bulletin boards. The one on the left carries the Board of Supervisors agenda. The one on the right has room for others. It's got the APCD, Air Pollution Control, agenda for Wednesday and so on. But I think now that you've made a move, that has to be regularized. And I also think it would be very nice if the coming agendas would be on the Health Department website at least 72 hours in advance. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Is there anyone else that wishes to speak on a subject that is not on the agenda? In that case, we will move on to the water quality regulation in San Luis Obispo County. And I guess I'll let you just introduce yourself and
We wanted to keep it a secret, so we didn't put our names on there.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Actually, my name is Curtis Batson. I'm the Director of Environmental Health. I've been here many times before and haven't been here in a while. It's nice to see you all again. As I understand it, the interest you have is in how water quality is regulated in San Luis Obispo County. Now, we could have put together maybe 40 hours, maybe 80 hours worth of educational materials, but I didn't think you were interested in that. So what we're going to do is give you a very brief, each one of us, we'll give you a very brief overview, and then we'll try to answer your questions. It seems like that will get to your interests the most. I have with me today Harvey Packard from the Regional Water Quality Control Board, and I have Jeff Densmore from the Department of Health Services. Now, let me try to give you a sort of an overview of water quality issues. There's many agencies that regulate water quality in a number of different ways, but between Environmental Health, the Department of Health Services, and the Regional Board, that's the vast majority of the regulation of the water quality in the county. So if I leave any other agencies out who actually do have some part of regulatory aspects, I apologize, but we certainly cover the vast majority of it. Let me see if I can start. The Department of Health Services and Environmental Health have a very similar responsibility. We regulate the drinking water, the water that comes to your tap in your homes. The way the workload is divided up in the state is the state of California regulates the larger water systems. And what I mean by that is those water systems that have 200 connections or more are regulated by the Department of Health Services. And they do a lot of the very same things, in fact, exactly the same things that Environmental Health does, except that we regulate water systems that are 199 connections or less. So the city of San Luis Obispo, as an example, is regulated by the state of California. We regulate maybe a small water system for a subdivision of 100 homes. That would be the example. The Regional Water Quality Control Board, however, regulates the water before it gets into the pipes, before it's, quote, drinking water in your homes. So their responsibility is to regulate virtually all waters in the state of California. And I'll let Harvey explain exactly, but they're much broader in scope, and their responsibility is the groundwater, if you will, and actually I think it's all beneficial. Water could be for beneficial uses, so it's fairly broad. So let me give you a little idea of what I'll give you a little idea of what we do in environmental health and a little bit of the scope, and then Jeff will come up, Jeff Densmore with DHS. I think he has a short PowerPoint presentation. Is that correct? And then Harvey will come up and give you a short spiel, and then we'll just answer as many questions as you have. Does that sound like a reasonable approach to this thing? Okay, yeah, in San Luis Obispo County, there are about 149 water systems that are regulated by Environmental Health. So there's 149 systems that are 199 connections or less. They have names that they're called non-transient, non-community systems, and there's certain standards for that, and transient non-community, and state small, and community systems. They have these terms that get used. They're not relevant necessarily to our discussion because most of the standards are the same, and the requirements are the same. They're, on a monthly basis, all these water system tests for bacteriological water quality, and they're looking at coliform organisms. But they also have a much more extensive sampling requirement for chemicals of various kinds. They're called primary drinking water standards, primary drinking water standards are those constituents that have a potential for causing a public health issue, public health concern. There's also secondary drinking water standards, and we'll get into that in a minute. But under primary drinking water standards, you have both inorganic and volatile organic chemicals or organic chemicals. Some examples of the inorganic chemicals would be aluminum, antimony, arsenic, mercury, cyanide, chromium. Those are referred to as inorganic chemicals. Well, actually, those were all metals that I just mentioned, but still, they're all inorganics. When it comes to organics, they're volatile organics, and they have some fairly good names. You've probably heard of some of them. MTBE, methyl tertiary butyl ether. That's one of them. There's 1,1-dichloroethylene. There's carbon tetrachloride. There's just a whole list. I'm not going to read them all to you. But those are the volatile organics, or the organics that are also tested for. There's also some non-volatile synthetic organic chemicals that are tested for. Ethylene dibromide, I'm going to read the ones I can because some of these are pretty long names. Simazine is another one. I don't know that chemical, but anyway, that's a constituent also tested for. Secondary drinking water standards are a little different. There are actually some constituents like MTBE that are both a secondary drinking water standard and a primary drinking water standard. Secondary drinking water standards are aesthetics. They are odor, taste, that kind of turbidity, things like that. So MTBE has a potential for a odor and taste factor. It's a secondary drinking water standard as well as a primary drinking water standard. So that's sort of the general scheme. When water systems don't pass their tests, particularly when they're being developed, these water systems are new, they're going in, then they have to have certain treatment put on the water system. I'm going to let Jeff, who is much more of an expert at that sort of thing, talk about, so when a water system doesn't meet standards, what do you do about it? One of the things is very simple, is they allow blending of water sources. So that if you have a water source that has a very low level of a particular constituent, can be blended with a well or a water source that has a higher level. The blended water then is tested to determine if it meets the maximum contaminant level. Sometimes you'll hear me say MCLs, it's maximum contaminant level. That's the terminology. So I'll try to say maximum contaminant level, but sometimes I shift into my acronym mode. So as far as the general scheme of things, that's how it works with regard to drinking water, water delivered to your tap. I think the next person, most likely person to come up and talk to you will be Jeff, because he has a lot of the same responsibilities that we have. He works for the State Department of Health Services, and he is responsible for the larger drinking water systems, more complex, obviously, than our smaller drinking water systems that we regulate. So, Jeff, why don't you come on up? I understand that there's a PowerPoint.
There is one.
And it's at that computer right over there. Okay. Gene can help you.
We have a question. Can we have our little prompters to work as well? The little screen we have here.
I don't know about that. I don't know about that part.
Well, where's Bob?
Sorry.
Then we need to go to the audience.
I'll make the phone call.
button. Oh, yeah, that, you guys do have copies of the slides. Okay, great. Well, should we wait, or do you, shall I get started? Or? Okay. Okay. Very good. So, as Kurt said, I work for the state, and it's the chain of command is kind of the federal government. EPA sets standards, and then each state is responsible, excuse me, for implementing those rules as stringent or more stringent than the federal government. And this, there's a similar relationship between the state and the county. So, you know, they've got to do at least what we're doing. So let me get into this presentation. It's just a real quick overview of what we do. Next slide. Okay, and these, each of these bulleted islands are kind of a keystroke. So there's the EPA. They've got primacy for the drinking water regulations, which means they set the regulation, and then each state is required to adopt that regulation, either as strict or more strict than that regulation. Okay, and then here's where the counties come in. Each state, in our case, California DHS, has delegated primacy to 34 of the 58 counties. In Ventura County, we still run the county program. They don't. Ventura County does not run the small water system program. We do, the state. But here in San Luis Obispo County, they have all the smaller systems under 200 service connections, you can see there. And then there's non-community water systems, and there's two kind of definitions of those. I'm not sure how interested you are in those, but basically I'll just give you some examples of transient systems, like your roadside rest stop, where you have maybe several different, or, you know, 100 people come in at once, but they're never coming back. Maybe they just stop there once, and they'll never come and drink that same water again. So the rules for that type of system are a lot more relaxed than a non-transient system, where a good example is that of that is like a business park. So you have the same people coming up to that building day in and day out, but they don't live there, so it's a non-community system. Okay. Next slide. Okay. Legal obligations of PWS, there's another acronym for you, it's public water system. Okay, and then the first bulleted item there is kind of our golden rule. Provide reliable and adequate supply of pure, wholesome, healthful, and potable water. Okay, and you also have to get a permit from our office or from the county. And that's if you're serving so many people with water, you have to have a permit. Okay. Here's some more legal obligations of a public water system. Those are all things that Kurt's kind of hit on. If you want me to slow down at all, please let me know, and I'll address any one of these bulleted items here. But that's essentially what Kurt has just addressed. Okay, these are kind of all of our standards here, and this table kind of shows you what constituents are looking for, as well as where you sample for that constituent. So system means out in the distribution system somewhere. So the bacteriological sample is pulled out in the distribution system because it's after disinfection. So you want to verify that your disinfection process is working properly. So you take your bacteriological samples in the system. Okay, and then any other, all those source water samples are taken from the source itself. So it's either a well or a lake or a river. Generally, it's right at the wellhead, so where they're pulling the water out of the ground or out of the lake or river, that's where they're taking that sample. So that's the system source designation there. And then, as you can see, there isn't a whole lot of transient systems on that type of system column there, the previous slide. But so you can see there that they don't really have a whole lot of source monitoring to do, or because of the fact I described earlier. Okay, and then the next slide talks about
how many samples, and this is for bacteriological sampling, so it's based on population. So the more people you serve, the more samples are taken. That's basically what this slide is showing. And then you can see, again, the transient systems, it's one per quarter there, you can see, or one per month. So, again, more lax regulations for a transient type system. So those are the minimum requirements for sampling. And then if you do get a positive, this is bacteriological sampling again. So let's say one of your samples is bacteriologically or coliform positive. There are some steps you're required to take if you do get a total coliform positive, which is TC. Okay, there's total coliform, which is not necessarily a health risk, but it's an indicator. So once you get a total coliform positive, you further analyze that sample to make sure it's not E. coli or fecal positive, which would mean there's some contamination issues going on there. So it says the water supplier shall collect a repeat sample within 24 hours of being notified, and that's by the lab. So the lab says, hey, you got a positive. The water system is required within 24 hours of that notification to get out there and get some repeat samples. And generally, let's see, yeah, next couple, yeah. So the repeat sample set, here you go. If you're only taking one sample a month, this is the routine sample set here. You take one at the original positive site, you go one within five connections upstream, which means the water is flowing this way in the pipe, and the original positive was here at this house, you go five connections upstream, within five connections upstream, and five connections downstream of that original positive. And then your other, and then if you're only doing one a month, they want you to do one other location somewhere else in your distribution system just to make sure things are okay. And hopefully all those come back clean. One of the reasons for a repeat sample is sometimes you do get a false positive, or the sample is contaminated on the way to the lab, or so you're just making sure that it actually is the water that was contaminated or did have the positive hit. So that's what this repeat sample is supposed to shake out. And then if you continue to get positives, you keep taking those repeats until either you found what the contamination is, or you don't get any more positives, essentially. So it's just a good investigation of, you know, where this contamination may be coming from, if it does exist at all. Okay, there are standards set. If you collect under 40 samples a month, you can only have two positive total coliform samples in that month. If you have any more than that, it's an MCL violation, maximum contaminant level violation, and you're required to notify your constituents, and it says there the following month you have to take five samples instead of the one that you normally take. So we want you to take a lot more samples the next month just to make sure everything is back to normal. Okay, inorganic monitoring. Kurt hit on this a little bit. These are inorganic chemicals that represent health risk to the consumer. Okay, and health risk, I guess I can get into that later, but all community and non-transient water systems and transient systems that serve over 1,000 people have to monitor for all these inorganic chemicals that are in this table here. And then, monitoring frequency for all of them except for nitrate, because nitrate is an acute health, has an acute health standard, meaning if you drink high nitrate water, you can become sick, you know, that day, especially babies. So groundwater sources, they're doing it every 3 years. Surface water sources are annually. Generally, surface water source is monitored more frequently than a groundwater source because the quality can vary so much more than a groundwater source. So that's inorganics in general, not nitrates. And then, as you can see here, nitrate is a special case. So we're just talking about inorganics except for nitrates here. If you do get a hit above the MCL, maximum contaminant level, there's some protocol here. You have to inform us within 48 hours or the county, which is the LPA, which is a local primacy agency. So that's kind of, there's DHS and the LPA. DHS is the state, LPA is the county, basically, health agency. Within 48 hours, and then begin quarterly monitoring. So whereas you were doing it every 3 years, now you're hitting it every quarter. Okay, and then that second bullet is, you can go that route if you think that result was a little screwy. Generally, we say if you get a hit that you don't normally get, you confirm that with a follow-up sample. So if that follow-up was negative, then you know you can maybe assume that that first one was a screw sample. Okay, next slide. Okay, primary, more on primary standards. Here's the nitrate. Everybody's got to do nitrate. So if you keep going under those bulleted items right here. So you can see transient systems are even thrown into this, and everybody does it annually, except for surface water sources. They're doing it quarterly, so every 3 months. And that's because it is an acute health standard. It is one of the things that if it's one of the constituents that we get kind of, we jump out of our chairs with if it's over the MCL, because people can get sick fairly rapidly. So that's why it is in its own kind of category here. If we go down to detections above the MCL, labs has got to tell the water system within 24 hours, and you got to get a confirmation sample on that. And then if the average of those samples are greater than the MCL, you tell us, and we get you on increased monitoring. And if it's less, then you know you can contact us within a week. And generally for sources that are over half of the MCL, the MCL is 45 milligrams per liter. If it's 24, then we have you do it quarterly instead of annually. Okay, detections above 50% of the MCL, that's what I just said there, conduct quarterly monitoring. Okay, here's the organic chemicals. These are generally run less frequently, every three years. Let's see here, monitoring required. So that's the initial monitoring there, says equals four quarters. So we want to know if there's any seasonal effects on your groundwater or your surface water source. So when you first get that source, we want to see a sample for VOCs every quarter just to make sure we're not missing something. And then you can reduce that. If we don't see any hits on that, we reduce it generally to every 3 years. And then the SOCs are synthetic organic chemicals. VOCs are like your gasoline products. SOCs are like your pesticide-type products. So they're, you know, man-made organic chemicals. And the SOCs we put out, and we customize those. So if you're in an agricultural area, you were looking for certain types of SOCs. If you were in another area where they're using different type of SOC for a different type of application, then you're looking for a whole other list of SOCs. We didn't find a whole lot of those, and we've kind of scaled back on the SOC monitoring across the state. Secondary standards. As Chris said earlier, these are put in place to protect you from aesthetic effects, so taste, odor, color, that type of thing. They're not necessarily a health risk. So it says they're consumer acceptability of the water. And there's a list of some examples of some secondary standards there, like iron and manganese. That's a pretty typical secondary standard we see around here. And then monitoring frequencies, you can see groundwater every 3 years, surfaces annually. Lead and copper monitoring. This is a system sample. So generally, you're not seeing a lot of lead or copper coming out of the ground, out of groundwater. It's generally a product of the plumbing. So the way we go about lead and copper monitoring is we ask the water system to collect a sample at 20, depending on the system size, at their customers' homes. So they're dropping sample bottles off at the customers' homes, and they tell their special instructions that go along with that. So you let the water sit in the pipe for so long, collect a sample, and then the water system comes back by and collects all those sample bottles from their customer homes. And then there's action levels for those lead and copper action levels instead of standards or primary secondary standards for lead and copper. So the monitoring requirements, you start out first round, second round, those are both 6 month samples. Then you go into annual, you got two rounds of annual sampling, and these are all taken in the summer. The annuals and the triannuals are all in the summer because the warmer water temperature generally increases the lead and copper levels. And then there's standard and reduced monitoring. So if your levels are low enough, we can reduce you to a lot lower frequency. I'm sorry, not frequency, lot left. So you may start out sampling 60 homes initially, and we can get you all the way down to 20 if your numbers are low enough. So you sample less homes if your lead and copper numbers are low enough. And then the next slide is a table that basically shows just that. So initially you start off, if you're a system between 501 and 3,300 people, is what that means there, you start out doing 20 samples. So for your first two 6 months and your first two annuals, you're doing 20 samples. If those all look good, we can reduce you to 10 every 3 years. But you're still doing the 10 samples every 3 years. And then the fewer people you serve, obviously the fewer homes you have to monitor. And then we basically bottom out at 5, so we're not going to let you sample any less than 5. Okay, and then one other regulation I'm going to hit on is the radionuclides reg, which is radioactivity. So we have gross alpha, which is kind of the general catch-all radiochemical test, and then there's several iterations of that if your numbers warrant it. So it applies to community and non-transient, non-community water systems. Again, initial monitoring is ramped up a little bit, so you're looking for gross alpha and radium-228. And then you can see here, if your gross alpha particle is less than 5, and that's picocuries per liter, it's just a measurement of the radioactivity, then you don't have to do the 228 or 226. And then uranium is also in that regulation. So if your numbers are above, if your gross alpha numbers are above a certain level, then it starts out at gross alpha, then if your number's over a certain limit, then you look for uranium. And then you subtract uranium from your gross alpha, and if that's over a certain number, then you're looking for a radium-228. So you're basically speciating the gross alpha sample. And I think that pretty much wraps it up. I will hit on the blending. Curtis mentioned blending a little bit for treatment. That is an acceptable treatment process. We do have permits out for that currently. And basically, this as he said, and a real good example of that, especially in this area, is a nitrate blend scenario. So if you do have a blend treatment, we have certain constraints on that. So you have your high concentration, let's use nitrate as an example. You have your high nitrate well here that's over the MCL, and you have a well on the other end of your system that's low in nitrates. Those two sources need to go to one spot without any stops, so they can't be serving any customers on low nitrate. Well, actually, no, that one can't stop either. They both have to go to the same spot without stopping. So you can't be serving water to anybody. That way you know this is how much water we have going into. Generally, it's a reservoir, so you're pumping water, high nitrate water into the reservoir and low nitrate water into the reservoir, and you know exactly how much you're pumping because all that water that you pumped out of the ground, you know the flow rate, you got a flow meter, you know exactly how much you're pumping into the reservoir from both sources. And then it's basically just a calculation, a blending calculation. So you have flow one, let's say the high nitrate well is, we'll use that as flow one, concentration one. The low nitrate source is flow two, concentration two. And then if you add those two flows together, you got flow three, right? And that's going to be flow one plus flow two is your flow three. And then you put those concentrations into this equation as well, and it's just a mathematical kind of a flow-rated weighted average, basically is what it is. And so we say you monitor the source every week. Let's see, you monitor the highest source every month, and you give us a daily blend calculation, which is, I kind of simplified that, but they're giving us a daily blend calculation. And then they also take a weekly blended sample. So out of that reservoir, they're collecting a sample every week, and they're taking it to the lab. And that lab sample should match up very close to their calculations. So we have a weekly check every month, plus they're sampling their high source every month for that as well. And it's very similar to, it's not a removal per se, you're just diluting it basically. And people are concerned that, hey, it's just dilution, but it's essentially the same as like a filtration process where, I mean, the process is different, but if you're filtering something, let's say you're filtering nitrates, you're not going to knock out every last bit of nitrate. It's just too cost prohibitive and generally is not possible. So what systems generally do is say, where's the limit? Let's remove just enough to get underneath that limit, and then we meet the regulations, which is perfectly fine because the limits are generally conservative in the first place. So, I mean, we set the limit at nitrate at 45, And generally, our blend goal is 80% of that MCL. So we want them to be, was that 32, somewhere in there. So if they start getting above that, we want to talk to them a little bit more, make sure their process is totally dialed in, make sure their effluent numbers are real consistent. And if we're comfortable with the operator in the system, then we may allow them to operate, you know, upwards of 80%. But generally, that's a good rule for the blending. So. Any other questions you guys might have?
I have a question.
Sure.
In the blending, do you have to have a mixer? Otherwise, if you're far enough apart as your water is coming into your reservoir, it might blend a little bit, but otherwise it's going to stay in its area. It's going to stay two different types of water rather than blending together. So do you require some kind of a mixing system?
That's a very good question, and it depends on, we don't generally require a mixing system. Generally with a reservoir setup, and it could even be in line as well. There are setups where a high nitrate well will come into a header or a pipeline, and it'll just mix in line. But we want to sample tap right where it blends. And generally, with a reservoir, that's a very good question, because that does happen. You can put water in, you can pull that same water out if there's not good mixing. So that is definitely a concern, and that is something we look at in their blending plan. So generally when the water comes in, it's coming at a pretty good velocity, and both of them, you know, there isn't a mixing mechanism that we tell people to put in, but if we did see numbers coming out of that reservoir that we weren't happy with, then we'd say, hey, this reservoir, there isn't good mixing in this reservoir, we need to do something else about it. But it isn't generally a requirement that we put on a blended system.
I have a couple questions. So let me make sure I understand that. Rather than improving or having whoever's got the high nitrate levels from doing something proactive to reduce those levels, it's just kind of swept under the rug, diluted, and then served?
Well, a lot of times the water system isn't responsible for the nitrates. It's something that, you know, Farmer John across the street is dumping a bunch of fertilizer on his strawberries or what have you, and it's, you know, the water system stuck with this well across the street, and it isn't sweeping it under the rug. It is as legitimate as a treatment as any other type of filtration. It's legitimate. What we're looking for is the number coming out of that blend. So regardless of how much nitrate you're putting into that reservoir, all we care about is the water that's going into the taps. So, and you would be doing the same thing with like an ion exchange. That takes out nitrates with the resin beads. So you're collecting all these nitrate, all this nitrate on this cartridge, and then when you're done with that, you're tossing that somewhere. So that's becoming someone else's problem. I mean, you're getting rid of it. You got to put it someplace, and you're not taking it. And with blending, you're just diluting it, like you said. But if you filter it, now you've got filter media with nitrate in it you've got to put somewhere. So it's really not putting it under the rug. I mean, it's very good. If people can blend, we highly recommend that they do it. It doesn't add to the health concern of the water. You're not making the water any less potable by blending. It's a very cheap option. Generally, if you filter, you have filter media, you have to operate, you need operator certification, a higher degree of operator certification for running that type of system. You have a waste that you've generated now, so now you have a waste issue if you're filtering. Whereas blending, you basically, as long as they have the infrastructure set up where it is a specific blend point, it is one of the cheaper options.
The point I'm getting at is that if Farmer John is putting all of this nitrate into the water system, isn't there any talking to Farmer John about his agricultural practices that we're being penalized for by this blending opportunity? Because even you're saying that even if you filter it, you're going to be left with the same substance that he originally added to the mix to make it unpotable water.
That's true, and yeah, this is, I mean, I work with the drinking water program, so on our end, and this is, I'm sure you're familiar with state agencies, you know, we each have our own little pot that we're in, and essentially, we just deal with potable water, and if there's somebody that's, the only way we would get involved with that is if they said, hey, we want to put a new well in right here, then we'd say, hey, have you seen?
I was just going to say that at the drinking water level, at the water that comes out of the tap that you drink, blending is a mechanism for treatment. I think what Pam is getting to is more the water quality in the ground. And I think the regional board would probably have, they could tell you a little bit more about how that is dealt with and whether or not Farmer John is responsible and to what degree and that kind of thing.
I was hoping beyond hope that, you know, it was all one pot of water, so to speak, and that, you know, there's different regulations, but if, you know, he's taking care of our drinking water in a system over 290 or 199 homes, then is he talking to this guy and is he talking to you, and how do we resolve the problem without, I mean, when we run out of clean water, what are you going to blend it with, I guess is where I'm going.
That's a good point. In our agency, we don't, like was just discussed, we're only concerned with the drinking water. And as I was saying, we would get involved with something like that if they wanted to put in a new source. So, hey, we want to put a brand new well in right in the middle of the strawberry patch. We'd say, maybe not a good idea. Have you seen the nitrate levels in the groundwater around here? So we may not permit something like that. But for something that's already in place, yeah, that's another agency. Unfortunately, you know, our agencies work separately, but there are places where we, you know, where we could mesh, definitely.
My last question to you for right now is that now that you've probably shied us all away from stopping at rest stops ever again, what other types of transient systems are we exposed to that we might not know about?
Well, I should, and maybe now is a good time to get into maximum contaminant levels and health standards and all that. Health standards are set. Just the gist of it is that they're based on a 70-kilogram person that drinks 2 liters of bottle, 2 liters of water a day for 70 years. That's what the limits are. That's how they're set. So they figure all the acute standards like bacteriological standards and nitrate that could get you sick immediately, those are monitored at transient systems. But the stuff that you have to drink for 70 years to get you sick, we're not real concerned with that because we figure you're not going to be hanging out at a rest stop for 70 years. So those are the, when I said more lax, that's what I meant. I didn't mean that we're totally ignoring the health standards there. They're just a little more lax for the chronic. They call those the chronic health effects. So for 70 years of exposure, we're looking at chronic health effects. So that's what I should have said.
A recent problem here with arsenic in the water supply to a school. Now, I note that you only have an arsenic check every 3 years. So that theoretically, these youngsters may have been receiving a high level of arsenic in the water for, you know, 2 years and 11 months without us knowing it. So, wouldn't that be of some concern that you could have a really high level and it could go on for 3 years without it being discovered?
It's kind of an interesting time right now with the arsenic regulation. It's been 50 and is currently 50 milligrams per liter. Am I saying that? Is that milligrams or micrograms per liter?
Micrograms.
So, it's 50 now, January 23rd. Of next year is 10. So systems that are over 10 but below 50 right now are in an interesting spot, right? Because they've met the regulation for the past however long that regulation's been in effect. But come January 23rd, they've got this new standard to come up to deal with of 10. So, and I'm not sure, I do have.
Well, you know, I'm sorry. That's not my question. It's how frequently that it checked. If it's only checked every 3 years.
You're correct. 3 years.
If it's checked every 3 years, that means that you could have a bunch of children, a bunch of, say, women who have got small fetuses and are probably more susceptible to the arsenic. You could have infants who are probably a lot more susceptible because their brains are forming and therefore they're a highly vulnerable tissue. This could be going on for 2.5 years. And it's like the lead story, you know, as I was mentioning you know, earlier, about 56 years ago, our view of lead poisoning was a youngster that came in with convulsions and almost mortally ill and had a very high level. But then as time went on, we discovered there were more subtle things that would happen in youngsters exposed to excessive lead. And we had to bring down our lead levels that we would allow considerably because we discovered that elevated lead, only moderately elevated lead, could be associated with mental retardation. And what concerns me, you have this population out there that might be getting excessive arsenic for 3 years without anyone knowing it, and they could be having very subtle disease, like not doing well in school or being hyperactive or whatever. And there's no way of putting your hands on it, really, because we don't routinely, as you know, in our ordinary well baby checkups, do blood levels for arsenic.
Well, if this well had ever been over the MCL in the past, there would have been increased monitoring. So we wouldn't, if it had been over the maximum contaminant level, we wouldn't have said, hey, just wait 3 years and we'll sample it again. It would have been on continuous basis. And if it had been over the MCL, treatment would have been required. And compliance is based on four cores. And I do have a history here from that well. And a March 05 sample was non-detect. And then 4 months later, it was over the limit. And then 2 months later, it was back to six. So they did, in 6 months, they sampled it 3 times in 05. And one of those was over the limit, and it was in between the two that are even below the new MCL. But that's a good point. I mean, the 3 years is it's all these, and I should say too, that this is a chronic health effect. It's based on 70 years of drinking the water, and all these studies they do to come up with an MCL.
Well, some populations, I'm sorry, are a lot more vulnerable.
Sure.
Like a very small embryo or a small fetus that might get it from the mother, or an infant that's breastfeeding, or just small children, and the actual signs of the disease might be very subtle. I mean, you don't pick up mental retardation very often until 5 or 6 years later in a youngster when starts having some problems in school. And the other thing is, I just wonder if when you find a high arsenic level, whether you ought to then start to survey the actual population, especially very small children, and do arsenic levels on them from their hair, for example, which is the best way to look for, of course, chronic arsenic poisoning.
Well, not the company, not the agency that I work for.
Yeah, but it would seem to me that there should be some kind of follow through. It's possible these kids got high arsenic levels for 3 years, and maybe some of them aren't doing well, some of them are. You don't know. But the parents aren't going to notice. The physicians who see them aren't going to really put two and two together, very likely. So it would seem to me that it would be important to go out and do some actual field testing on the actual subjects who receive the excessive arsenic.
Well, we just deal with drinking water, and I don't really have no expertise in human studies. I really wouldn't know what to do. But at this point, with all the information we have here, we would still need more confirmation that well is actually over the arsenic level. Right? And at this point, we have, to me, what looks like an anomaly. I mean, it's a huge spike. It goes up to 57. and back down to 6 within two months. It goes from 0 to 57 back down to 6. To me, that looks like an anomaly, and I would like to see a lot more data on that well before I would say that they have an arsenic problem, or even before I tell them to put in treatment. To me, 3 data points and 1 as high as it is, to me, it's not conclusive that well is high in arsenic. Although they did get a hit, and there's definitely confirmed that there is arsenic in that well, I would feel very uncomfortable saying that that well is over the arsenic level with any degree of certainty.
What would prompt you to go look for a source of arsenic? I mean, where does arsenic come from that gets into water, and what would prompt you to go look for that?
It's actually a naturally occurring substance, so it dissolves out of the rock formations.
But why would a well that's been negative for a long time suddenly
help
arsenic?
That's a very good question. That's one of the reasons I would like to see more monitoring done for this. We see that with nitrates a lot. Nitrates can move through the subsurface and just all of a sudden you get a giant spike, and then it's gone. It's just like a flush that goes through there underground. And I couldn't tell you what happened on July the 13th that we got a 57 out of that. But it is a naturally occurring mineral.
I wanted to ask a somewhat similar question, and that is, other than I understand seasonal variations where your water table goes up and down, in my mind, maybe is more concentrated, maybe not, in a low water year. What other factors would make arsenic or nitrates suddenly spike, or do you expect them to something like arsenic to stay fairly stable over years? If you do initial quarterly tests and then do a test every 3 years, would you expect it to go up and down that much?
No, and I just had this discussion with Marina Michaud, works with Curtis. And it's similar to what we've seen. We do have some wells that have low levels of arsenic in it, and it's very, very linear. I mean, it fluctuates very little. You know, it'll go from 5 to 7 to 6 and just bounce around, just very, very little. Definitely not jump around. Nitrates, we have seen do that. We have seen nitrates just spike way up and then back down again. But arsenic, from what we've seen, and we don't have a lot of it in our district, but from what we've seen is very consistent level.
Okay, and so what's the continued monitoring required of this well of concern?
For this arsenic well, we would have them follow up on this definitely more, and there probably is another hasn't reached our database yet. There probably is more monitoring on this, but we would have them doing it quarterly for sure. The regulation is based on a quarterly average, so you could have let's use the new MCL of 10. You could have one quarter you could be at 11, but the rest of the quarters you could be at 8, and you're still fine. You still meet the regulation.
And all of the water systems that around that, are there other ones that maybe have current levels of 35 or 45, and will they have to be measured more often than every 3 years when the new standards go in, or are they kind of grandfathered to only get measured every 3 years even though the standards have changed?
No, they are under the gun at the moment. So if systems that are over 10 are scurrying around right now trying to find some type of treatment to get the arsenic out. And we have a good example up in Cuyama, Santa Barbara County, northeastern Santa Barbara County, and this guy is a real small community, and he said, our water's been fine, our water's fine, but on January 23rd, I guess people are going to start dropping dead or something. He was referencing the arsenic MCL, and it's true. I mean, on the 23rd, the switch flips, and now we got a new standard. So all those systems that are between 10 and 50, they're either looking to blend, filter new sources, but they've got to find something. They can't put that water out over 10 anymore.
Thank you very much.
I have one more question.
Okay, Commissioner Pinkel.
I understand that in the West, I don't know about California, that arsenic compounds are often used as herbicides. Is that true here in California or the Central area?
I don't believe so, but I can't say.
That's what my pharmacology book tells me.
I did read that that was in the past. You know, they used it, and I gather now that they still use it in medicines.
Oh yeah, we use it in medicine. We use it for leukemia. Yeah.
But I'm not sure if it's still a current practice.
Use arsine or any of the other arsenic.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you for sure.
I mean, is it allowed here in California? Because in some places it's not allowed, so I just don't know what's the...
I can't speak for certain, but I can imagine if some places in the U.S. don't allow it, then California is probably on board with that. But I can't say for certain.
You know, I don't know specifically, but I know that we had an issue with the berries at a ranch in Napomo, and there was some discussion with the Ag Department at that time about, you know, could it be, you know, some sort of an pesticides that have some sort of a arsenic derivative. And they thought that they indicated that even though at that place there was no indication of it, because I think it's an organic farm, they at least didn't lead me, they didn't say anything like, no, it's not allowed in California, but I don't know.
I was in another meeting with the ag folks, and they said, we'll go down and do an inspection of a farm in Napomo to see if there's any old pesticides that he might have kept that would be pretty old, because it's illegal to have arsenic-based pesticides. Now, there, until recently, and I'm not sure whether it's currently true, but cupric arsenate has been a chemical that's been impregnated deeply into certain kinds of wood to prevent termites. So that's the only source that I'm aware of where arsenic may be currently used.
Because if you have a fluctuation, you wonder. Pardon?
Other than in medicine.
Well, thank you very much. I think we have one more speaker, and we are coming close to the end of our time for this subject. Why don't you hold it till after the water, regional water quality?
Okay. Good evening. My name is Harvey Packard. I'm with the Water Quality Control Board. And as Kurt mentioned at the very beginning, we regulate water quality before it gets into water systems. So we're interested in environmental water quality. And the mission of the state and regional boards is to protect and enhance the quality of California's waters. And we have several programs that we implement to do that. I'll just mention a few of the ways that you see us in the news. We're not a high profile agency, but you may have heard of us in the news every once in a while. For instance, when there are sewage spills, you'll hear the regional board, you know, is following up with the agency that spilled. San Luis Obispo had a spill into the creek in, I think it was August, and we regulate the city of San Luis Obispo's wastewater treatment plant. They violated their permit by discharging raw sewage into the creek, so that's obviously something we're interested in our following up with. You'll see us in the news with getting permits for power plants. The Federal Clean Water Act defines heat as a pollutant. And so we regulate the Diablo Canyon power plant and the Duke plant in Morro Bay because they're discharging heat into the ambient water. You may have heard about groundwater cleanups in the Guadalupe oil field. That's something we're very interested in. We have programs that deal with hazardous materials in the environment. Try to find what we call the responsible parties, make sure they're cleaning up the waste that they discharge to the environment. Avila Beach is another example of one of those. Cambria, Kurt mentioned MTBE, a gasoline additive that was spilled in Cambria And as you know, they have severe water shortages, and they're very concerned about their water supplies. I haven't said Los Osos yet. That's probably one you you might associate with the regional board. I won't go into that unless someone has questions. I'm not totally involved now, so we don't need to get into that. I mentioned the discharge permits. That's one of our major programs. We regulate any type of pollutant discharge that may have an effect on water quality. And it could be surface water quality. It could be groundwater quality. An example is City of San Luis Obispo, where they discharge treated wastewater directly to San Luis Obispo Creek. Our job is to make sure that anybody who might use the water downstream of that discharge can still use the water for any use that should be reasonably foreseen. The Federal Clean Water Act talks about making all waters fishable and swimmable. That's the goal we use. Another example of a wastewater treatment system would be one that the county runs. For example, there's quite a few of them that the county runs. One is Oak Shores up at Lake Nacimiento. They treat their wastewater and dispose of it using spray irrigation, where the wastewater is taken up by plants that grow naturally. We also regulate industrial waste discharges. I mentioned power plants. Some other examples are wineries, desalination plants, gravel mining, vegetable packing, oil refining. Those are types of facilities that we're regulating. We also have a stormwater program where we regulate, we try to get a handle on one of the largest pollution issues that we have now, and that's polluted stormwater. We have industrial stormwater permits for existing facilities. Anybody who does anything outside that might cause their stormwater runoff to be polluted have to meet certain standards with our agency. We have construction stormwater permits for anybody disturbing an acre or more. They have to have a plan to take care of the sedimentation that might result from that disturbance. We have our hazardous materials programs I mentioned. We have a program that we call our non-point source program. That's kind of a large umbrella term for anything other than what we call point source discharges, which would be wastewater from wastewater treatment plants or industries. And a relatively new program we have that fits in that category is our agricultural regulation. We now require that ag operations in using row crops, we have certain standards that they need to meet. Grading is something that we're interested in. It's a non-point source type of pollution. That's a really quick overview, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
I have a question. There's a lot of people who use the dunes and their vehicles up and down the dunes and are contaminating the area with gasoline and oil. And what have you got that you can use to clean that up? And do you clean it up? And if you don't clean it up, why doesn't the state stop that kind of activity in the water area?
All right. Are you talking about gasoline that may fall on the sand and soak in the ground or the creeks there? I'm not familiar with any data that show there's an issue with the altering vehicles in the dunes. We have done a lot of water quality testing in the Guadalupe Dunes area and found a lot of pollution where we know the oil was spilled, but I can't recall of any data that would show there's a pollution problem from cars or motorcycles. I'd love to see some data if you have some.
I have a question for you, Harvey. Thank you for coming tonight. Mm-hmm. The ag regulations are fairly new.
Right.
And I think you've already gone through the first round of testing. Could you kind of give the commission an overview of what you're finding?
That's a hard one. Basically, the regulations require two things. They require that the ag the ranchers they have to take a farm water quality class, which talks about how to use pesticides and herbicides safely.
and they have to do some water quality monitoring. And we allow them to group together to form cooperatives to do larger scale monitoring, which is more effective, we think. And we have that monitoring plus our own monitoring programs. And as you said, it's a fairly new program. I doubt we'd be able to tell anything now of the effects of this new program. You know, it's just way too short of a time period. You mentioned, well, Jeff mentioned Farmer John and his nitrate. It's going to take a lot of monitoring and a long time to see the effect of improved fertilization practices to see that effect in groundwater.
It was my understanding that they already did the first round of testing and that they were finding high levels. And I guess I'm looking for baseline information from where do you go from here? I mean, mm-hmm. New program, there was reason for that program to be
right.
put into effect because there was runoff, there was contamination.
Right.
And it's my understanding that there are results that, you know, have come out of the first round. And
okay,
I would really like for the commission to know what those results are.
I thought you meant results, showing results of improvement. I don't know what the data are showing. I'm not familiar with the data that have been collected to show. I know that in the past, when we've collected ambient water quality around ag operations, yeah, you do find high nitrate in the ag return waters. You find pesticides and herbicides. And I definitely wouldn't be surprised if that's what they found in their first round of sampling. I can get the data for you and hook you up with the right people to look at it.
I had one question that as you're all are you all working together, and what's the mechanism when something such as seeing that arsenic level, do you contact each other, or are you working together, speaking with each other, say contacting public health to test the children at the school? How does that work? How do you guys work together?
We have access to all of the data that water providers collect as part of their DHS requirements. So we have access to the arsenic data that they collected in Napomo, and we tend to use those types of data on a larger scale. We look at a basin as a whole, and we'll try to find out, is there a nitrate problem in the Napomo Basin? Is there an arsenic problem? I don't think you can say on the large scale that there's an arsenic problem in Napomo. Definitely an issue with that well, but there are many, many wells in that area, and for instance, Napomo Community Service District supplies water to a lot of people. They have many wells, and I don't think they have arsenic issues in any of their wells. So we have that data. We deal closely with Department of Health Services and the county on pollution issues like that.
One of the things I want to add is my understanding that particular well that's servicing that school, they have stopped using at least at the moment. Now, whether it'll get back online or what or under what circumstances, that's unknown at the moment. But that well is currently not being used.
It's my understanding that they're going to try to keep that well from ever being used for potable purposes. Napomo CSD wants to supply the schools with potable water, and the school district will use that well for irrigation only.
That's my understanding as well.
One point I wanted to make also is that the community water systems at the county and DHS regulate don't regulate the individual user. What's the minimum number of hookups? Is it 3 or 4?
For the county, we regulate everything above 5 connections.
5 connections. So to get back to your question, Dr. Pinkle, individual homeowners who have wells, a lot of times they have no idea what's in their water.
Most people don't do it, unfortunately.
Right. In fact, we had a situation in Santa Clara County similar to the arsenic, except it came about because there are always new chemicals emerging that we learn about or that we have the ability to test for at lower standards. Turns out there's, in southern Santa Clara County, people have been drinking water with perchlorate in it for, it could have been decades, and hundreds, if not thousands of people. We had no idea until we had the ability, or the laboratories had the ability to test down low enough to find it.
Don't you think it's reasonable, it's rational to review the histories and the physical findings of those youngsters that have been drinking it, and also take a random sample? You wouldn't take them all and do arsenic levels.
Right. In that case, in Santa Clara County, the local health agency did work with the, I know I won't get the name right, but it's a federal agency associated with the CDC, the cancer registry, the same people that do the find cancer clusters. They did come in and examine health records to see if they could find any incidence of perchlorate effects.
Yeah, that would seem to be very reasonable. And that's a very good group, by the way, a field epidemiologist from Atlanta.
This is maybe kind of a stupid question, but I was just curious with regard to investigation of complaints or concerns. You know, my tap water smells like MTBE. You know, do you guys field those complaints?
We get calls like that all the time. If we always ask them, well, are you drinking water from your own well, or are you being served by a city? If you're being served by a city, we'll tell them you need to talk to your either the county or DHS and get a hold of the data. If it's an individual well, we'd definitely be interested. We'd want to go out and see if there's any potential sources nearby. You know, there's a gas station across the street or whatever, and figure out what's going on.
So a person with a concern should start with their water provider as opposed to calling you. That's what they should do.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like that might be a way to get shined on a little bit about, oh, your water's fine.
Well, I mean, the city may have reason to do that, but DHS certainly doesn't.
You need to talk to the microphone because you're on the for television's sake.
Okay, so yeah, we would definitely encourage people to come or to call us if they had a water quality concern, complaint, their water looked, tasted funny, and then we would say, okay, who serves your water? Who serves you water? And a lot of times people don't know that, but then we tell them, okay, look at your water bill.
What's your phone number?
What's my phone number?
Well. If they're going to call you guys, where do they call you?
Oh, they yeah. So depending on where they're at, if they're in the Tri-Counties area, they're calling us at 805-566-1326 is our main line. And there's four engineers in our office. And then we can help you. And generally, we ask who's serving you water, and we'll get right on it. And then, we call the water system and say, look, we've had this complaint. Have you had any other complaints today? What is there anything unusual happening out there? We start quizzing them all and that stuff. And then we say, okay, well, get on it and get back to us and tell us what you find, because we will call the customer back or have the water system respond to the customer. Either way, we want to know from the water system that everything's been taken care of. And a lot of times we'll follow up too with the customer and say, you know, did they call you back? Has someone come out there to check on things? Just some general guidance generally.
And of course that same thing applies to the smaller water systems that we regulate.
One last question from Commissioner Hetherington.
Kurt, a few years ago, there was a lot of complaints down in the Oceano, Halcyon area about the water. And I think it came to the point where there were wells capped and the Arroyo Grande was actually delivering water to people in some of the trailer parks down there. And you and I had talked a couple years ago about that, and you kindly sent me some of the capping reports, and you go out and you cap a well, but you don't put a reason in why you cap it. Is there some mechanism to change that? I mean, if somebody came back 5 years later and said, oh, by the way, I have a gastric cancer that I think came from the water, and yet you've capped a well and there's no reason why it's capped. Is there any mechanism for change to have that addressed and that it would state a reason for the capping?
Okay, to answer your question, I would say bottom line is no. There's no reasons that are given. Generally, a well, in terms of capping a well, we refer to that term as either inactivating it or destroying it. Inactivation is probably what you're talking about. If you're going to leave the well sort of there, but you just don't want it to be used, you can cap it or put a seal on the top of it to keep it from being a conduit for anybody falling in or any contaminants getting in. That's generally a short-term solution. If the well is not going to be used anymore for some reason, then it's pretty hard to turn around here talking to the microphone. Anyway, if the well is not going to be used, then we prefer that it be destroyed, which they have to do a lot more. They literally have to make that well inaccessible. But again, there's no reason that's documented that I'm aware of that says we're going to destroy this well or we're going to cap it for X, Y reason.
But records have to be kept for how long of the results of the water testing, the mandated water testing?
Well, true. We keep the records for the testing. But it's,
for how long?
Oh, geez. You would ask that question. I don't.
I believe it's
10
years.
Is it 10?
Thank you all very much. We appreciate your coming. Eric, we're kind of at the end of the time for this. And we need to move on. We have another speaker scheduled, so thank you.
This is an agenda item. I have the opportunity
to speak. Oh, all right. Okay. Well, then, my mistake. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I have one question for DHS and one question for the regional board. Obviously, I could ask dozens more, but in relation to DHS, my question is these thresholds that are set where you blend to an acceptable level, I presume this has to do with some calculation of acceptable risk. And obviously, sometimes those calculations change based on new information, such as has happened with arsenic. What is considered an acceptable level of illness? Is it like 1 in 100,000, 1 in 10,000? What is the threshold for what's considered acceptable for setting that? That's my first question. Of course, I share Dr. Pinkel's concern about the most vulnerable members of the population, the youngest, the immune compromised, et cetera, et cetera. My question for the regional board is septic tanks and septage. As growth fans out into more and more suburban and rural sprawl, we have more people living with septic tanks which are failing. We also have a project in Los Osos that's going to call for 4,700 of them to be pumped out and the septage to be disposed of somewhere. I know at a regional board meeting I saw how the Santa Barbara sewage treatment plant essentially crashed when they got, say, 10 septic tanks worth in a day. Where is it now recommended that the contents of septic tanks be taken? How is that stuff going to be handled as we get this proliferation of them? It's not sewage. It's a whole different texture, density, and nastiness. And what are people supposed to do with this, or should we stop allowing development scattered all over the place on septic tanks? Are we getting an avalanche coming? Thank you.
I'll answer the second question. The case in Santa Barbara had to do with porta potties, not septic tanks, and those have chemicals in them that can cause problems at wastewater treatment plants. Septic tanks, if they're operated correctly and homeowners aren't putting things in them that they shouldn't, don't have anything in them that would cause any problems at a wastewater treatment plant. As far as Los Osos goes, we don't anticipate that all 4,700 tanks will be pumped on the same day. People will be hooking up to the treatment plant over time. As they abandon their tank, they will have to have it pumped. And obviously, that's it's a large volume. Santa Maria, I know, takes septage. There could be other plants that I'm not aware of around here.
Actually, Eric hit on an issue in this county in that there is no place in this county within the county limits that accepts septage from a septic system. It either goes to the city of Santa Maria, or I think it goes someplace in the Central Valley, but no place in this county accepts it. That's been a significant issue. At least it could be a significant issue.
And question number one, I think, was acceptable risk. I believe it's one in a million. I'm not sure on that, but there's different thresholds for chronic and acute. I won't go into the whole thing, but I believe for chronic effects, acute effects is one in a million, I believe.
All right, I think we'll move on. Thank you very much, everybody. We have just as a housekeeping measure, we'll take a break after the next presentation. So we have Mr. Larry Becue here to give a report on the CHC. Yes.
Good evening, everybody, all your commissioners. First of all, I want to thank you. My name is Larry Bacusa, and I'm with Community Health Centers. I want to thank you all for inviting us to give an annual report of the partnership between San Luis Obispo County and Community Health Centers. I have a brief slide presentation that will make it easier to go through this report. Anyway, what is the County of San Luis Obispo partnership with CHC? It's pretty simple. It's our partners for better health care, just to put it simply. Partners for better health care. Community health centers of the Central Coast have joined forces with the County of San Luis Obispo to provide improved health care services for residents of San Luis Obispo County. The partnership will offer improved access, expanded hours, and additional locations and services. Most patients will continue to see the same physician and staff to ensure uninterrupted quality health care. Joining the community health centers of the Central Coast will be the county's family care centers. These are the clinics that the county had were managing before this partnership. And basically, they were in Atascadero, Morro Bay, here in San Luis Obispo. And it also includes the San Luis Obispo Women's Health Clinic. There also were some part-time county clinics that were operated in Paso Robles and Grover Beach, which have been integrated into our CHC sites in Arroyo Grande and our site there in Paso Robles. This story that you saw at the beginning is a story that I really want to tell. It's a successful partnership. It's a successful story. And one of the things that I think that made it successful is the fact that when all the stakeholders got together, there were certain things that they all had to kind of come to terms with. And one of them is agree on the mission, the values, the philosophy of the effort. Determine the values of participation of other agencies, individuals, or groups. Discuss community values and prevailing attitudes and perceptions, determine desired outcomes of the partnership effort, agree on process for coming together, agree on process for working together. We actually had to duke it out a couple times. Establish ground rules, identify responsibility for follow-up, determine the meeting guidelines, set regular dates, set beginning and end time, determine the agenda content, and discuss the financial viability, which is very important. Some of the important factors for this this partnership was defining the roles and the responsibilities of both entities. Agree on the contributions and the expectations. Identify capabilities and interests of participants to assume work roles in the collaborative effort. Document roles and responsibility. Identify available resources individual or agencies can provide. Additional factors, important factors, are timeliness of this issue, the scope of the collaboration, process issues, establishing ground rules, identifying responsibility for follow-up, inclusion of all affected stakeholders, sufficient stakeholders' incentives. One of the things that in my organization is that we, our CEO, Ron Castle, had been at the helm for at CHSA for the last 26 years, and he's always mentioning to us about the vision, and these are some of the visions that he's had as far as elements that contribute to a healthy community. And one is the cost-effective delivery of services through CHC, integrated services delivery model, our referral network, county-wide safety net to create a medical home, county financial grant to CHC for indigent care, elimination of duplication of services, comprehensive services beyond the mandated FQHC services. In an FQHC system, basically, they just mandate primary health care. And because of some of these other visions that we talk about, you know, this other ancillary health care, podiatry, chiropractic care, dentistry, which we also provide. So, you know, many of you may not know about the FQHC stuff, but basically primary health care is what is basically mandated of our organization as far as getting some of the Fed's money. So we go beyond that. And when this all took place, there was a period that we all knew that we were all kind of, you know, you know, kind of praying and hoping that there would be nothing wrong, there would be no mines. But, you know, after this, after the year or after the transition period, we really didn't notice too much. We either had to do with a lot of the dedication, the hard work on both sides, both with the county staff, the Board of Supervisors, and with you all. I think we were able to look at some of the issues that we've had to face and to deal with them, try to deal with them in a timely manner, trying to develop a process. But it was, you know, even for the folks that were actually making this transition, you know, changing of the computers, changing a system, it was a whole new culture for the county folks. It was a whole new culture for our folks working with the county folks. So there was a whole lot of things. And so I think the work that was put in before all that, it worked out okay. You know, we didn't see any real problems in the care that we had to provide. Anyway, Community Health Centers have never pursued an undertaking the magnitude of the county contract, and we are proud of the accomplishment that we have accomplished. Together, the County of San Luis Obispo and CHA accomplished a seamless transition for the patients and community. In fact, you know, we are actually going out to the nationally to let other folks in other states that have FQHCs and counties to let them know how this had all gone, so that if they decide that this is what they would like to do, then, hey, who knows? According to various surveys, the patients are extremely satisfied with the transition and new partnership. In the contract itself, there are compliance issues, and that's also to, develop a process to survey patients to see if they are satisfied with the care. We have five questions that we ask, and we are looking at, in order to maybe ask other questions, we're looking at now surveying the CMSP patients to see how they are being cared for. So we're looking at other ways to find out if they are really satisfied. But the surveys that we have now, we are finding that they are satisfied. The concerns brought forth by patient agencies and the Board of Supervisors were resolved in a timely manner. And I believe that's because, you know, we come to these kind of meetings. I meet with the county, some of my staff, Chris as well, meet with county folks, and we do this on a very routine, sometimes twice a month, and we meet and discuss these issues. And, you know, and we take minutes so that we know that nothing will fall through the cracks, and it works out. The outcome after 1 year, the compliance and goals. In this contract, there was a lot of compliance that had to be complied with. And through the whole year, we may not have met some of the compliance, but at the end, the fourth quarter, we got them all, which is very is very exciting for us. Community health centers work very hard to achieve the goals set forth by the county contract. There has been considerable progress in meeting with contract goals during the first year. CHC is looking forward to the second year of our partnership as we continue to implement new programs such as podiatry and other facilities. This is a five-year contract that we have with the county. So this is going to be our second year. Community health centers will continue to work hand-in-hand with the county as we continue to provide services to those without the resources to obtain care in the private sector. Compliance and goals. While successfully expanding our services, CHC has retained employees previously with the county, hired additional staff from the private sector, and enhanced the job market in the community. Here's a little map of where we are located in California. Another map of where all our clinics are located in the central California, coast of California. And here are the where all our clinics are. We have a new site, which is in Lompoc, Santa Barbara County. We have a clinic in Oceano that's going to be opening up pretty soon here. We just opened up Cambria, and so that's up and running. And we also are now providing podiatry services in our system. Through the whole year, if you look at this this graph here, you'll see that the complaints have in June, and you know I can tell you now for July, August, and September, it really hasn't gone up. I will note though that we do not have an ombudsman person during that period. I don't know if that's is that a reasoning or not, but EOC I believe is still looking for a person to fill that position. And then this whole partnership, actually, you know, we talked about access. If you look at the 3 years, you have 2002 to 3, and then if you look at the yellow, it's like a 50% increase of patients that we have, or patient visits, which is quite a bit. Patients access, this is some of the criteria. If you look at the fourth quarter, it's all been met. Can you go back, guys? If you notice, these are first, second, third, and fourth quarter. So you see the these are in the contract. And if you can see, these have all been met. The patient satisfaction, quality assurance, same thing. Immunizations, this is something, you know, that I know is dear to Dr. Thomas's heart. The immunization of children. We started off kind of rough here where we needed to get them all into a registry. And you know what? We finally were able to meet that criteria towards the end. Medical home, what that means is that the patient, when they come to a clinic, they'll see the same doc. It's not like, you know, they'll be assigned to another doc. Usually that's what community health centers try to do throughout the United States is when a patient come in, they see the same doctor. a lot of times they will see someone else if the doctor's on vacation or something to that effect. But in most cases, we try to have them see the same physician, and you know, and it's considered a medical home for them. So when they come in, they'll have their own doc. Financially, there are some compliance issues in the financial part, and I believe if you look at this, we've met them all. But basically, what they're trying to do here is to make sure that we see indigent patients underserved, patients, you know, we don't just go after all the Medi-Cal type patients, but that we do see patients who don't have insurance. That we and this is what this is saying. In pharmacy, I have Chris here, but I'll go and do that. This in the pharmacy is a separate contract from the primary care contract, and again, you know, as far as the prescription, the number of prescriptions, and we've actually had a lot of issues with pharmacy, and basically we probably have a few more still that we need to kind of iron out. And I think as the end, you know, when they do this Medicare D thing, that's going to be, and there's some other issues that we are going to be facing. But all in all, with the pharmacy, we have actually complied with all the with the different compliance criteria that was requested in the contract. And basically, these are just the turnaround times for non-formulary, the new prescription and pre-authorized refills, things like that. What does this all mean? Increase access to comprehensive quality health care, quality care for patients, financial savings to the public, and also a benefit to the community as a whole. The bottom line, greatest beneficiary is a patient and a community. The safety net is much stronger for primary care now than it was, actually it should be more than 15 years, months ago. As you can see, I probably had this already, this report done before. I'd like to thank the vision for this partnership with CHC CEO, the CHC Board of Directors, and the County Board of Supervisors. And this success story is just beginning. CHC would like to thank all of you health commissioners for your dedication to making our community a healthy one. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the commissioners? Commissioner Massey?
For those of us who weren't here last year, could you give us some background as to how this partnership came about?
Sure. I've actually been here when the contract actually started, but there's some issues before this contract, and with the General Hospital closing down, and then I believe that there was a push to see what was going to happen with the community health, with the family care centers, which the county was running. And basically there was a push to try to make them FQHC. Well, community health centers is an FQHC. We already have been in the area. We've been here for the last, 25 years as an FQHC. And so it made sense that that the county would just say, you know, would look at what we could provide as far as the services. And they actually, if you look at the savings that they, I believe it's like $5 million that they were able to save the first year. I think it gets less, but I think that the whole thing had to do with go ahead. Yeah, Dr. Thomas.
I certainly was intimately involved with a lot of the discussions over the years. I was the medical director at the Family Care Center from 1988 until 1998. The county was not able to use the Federally Qualified Health Center rate of reimbursement, which is between $115 and $120 per visit, but does include the visit plus some pharmacy, lab, et cetera. So it's not just for the visit with the physician or mid-level. And as several things happened. First of all, General Hospital closed. We had a physician group that had come through the management company, Camden, or pre-Camden, sorry. And that physician group helping provide physician services fell apart. Several years before, the board had kind of one by one, several of the physicians had left, and the they had decided to go with essentially a locum tenens company to provide physician services. And when General Hospital closed and this physician group was leaving, CHC provided, we contracted with CHC to provide the medical service through physicians and looked at could the county become an FQHC. For a number of reasons that we went through the effort, that was not possible. We looked at could we become an FQHC and CHC manage, be the management company that did it, and indeed we had some negotiations. We looked at it, but part of the issue was that the medically underserved area, medically underserved population, lived in Arroyo Grande, South Napomo area, and North Coast. So the bulk of our services, 90% of our services, were not in those medically underserved areas. And so we were not able to get the FQHC designation. And in the end, we looked at the three big issues were access, improving access, because we were having limitations in our services in Paso. We were seeing adults 2 days a week. We were seeing kids only in Morro Bay and in Grover Beach. And we looked at what the alternatives were. This is what made a lot of sense in improving access, continuing to push quality care, development of a medical home, and cost efficiency. So there was about a year process or more of negotiation to develop what we could all live with in terms of the contract itself, performance standards in the contract, and then implementing it. So I hope that helps kind of lay out the...
There's probably more to it, too.
there's a lot more. That's the short story.
Questions? Any other questions from commissioners? Commissioner Hale? And then Commissioner Warren.
You'd kind of hinted at, you know, some of the cost savings and you know, budgetary concerns. I mean, two things happened. Number one, there was a cost savings to the county reflected directly in the general fund by giving the responsibility and contracting with CHC. The other is that CHC has been able to bring more revenue into the county as well through its FQHC status, particularly with regard to Medi-Cal patients, which, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, which is basically cost shifted to provide some care to some of the other indigent and, you know, stepwise paying patients.
Yes.
I think that one of the confusions that I still hear is with regard to CMSP and those programs. How is that reflected in CHC and those patients, those CMSP patients?
Actually, the there's a you know, going back to the track record of the CMSP and the expense, that's actually built into the contract. So we, you know, it's we see them all, and basically the primary care portion we do provide. We do provide some specialty care. We say it's the first consult is on CHC, and then if we can find someone, let's say a specialist outside that would take one of these patients, then CMSP will pay for the specialty part. But you know that amount of money, I don't remember what it is now, but it's already built into that amount that they give us once a month. Is that about right, Dr. Thomas?
That's right. It's about $6 million a year. For the primary, for CHC and the pharmacy together.
Yeah, which includes the pharmacy.
And Larry said something about a survey of CMSP recipients. We, Public Health is doing a survey. We're sending out 500 surveys to people who received, who were CMSP recipients who received services at CHC during 2005 to survey their perceptions of their access, the quality of care they received, and also the pharmacy services. And So we're hoping to get at least half of those back, which would give us a 10%, 250 responses.
What's the time frame for that response?
We're sending them out this month, and hopefully we'll have them back in the next month or so. The other thing is that our analysis, the county's analysis, it says that there was a, I believe it was a 59% growth in the number of patient visits at CHC in fiscal year 04-05, as opposed to 24% growth in Santa Barbara County. So, you know, there was certainly a much larger growth in CHC visits, as we would have hoped and expect in San Luis Obispo County.
I just wanted to comment on the progress and all the great work that CHC clinics are doing and offering, because I do refer a lot of people over there, and I ask, and they're just amazed to have a medical home that's consistent, and they see the same doctor, and people are finally getting used to doing that, and that's been a great improvement, and I think that helps add to the number of visits. But I think that as people get used to having a different kind of medical care rather than just when it's an emergency, we're going to see even more. Thank you.
No, thank you, Commissioner Warner.
I have a quick question about your patient satisfaction quality assurance. Number three, it says quality of care measures and A, and I don't understand A. Credentialing requirement met 95% of the time. That, does that mean physicians? Only 95% of your physicians are qualified?
Yeah, this is part of the con. It's, you know, what credentialing is a process.
Right.
Yeah, and we basically, and yeah, this is well, in the contract itself, but we do it 100%. Yeah, we don't take the 5% that don't have a credentialing.
Well, it says 50% of physicians providing primary adult medical care obtain NCQA diabetes physician recognition certification.
Yeah, this is something that's in the contract, and basically what it is that 50% of our primary care docs will have this accreditation after 2 years. So we have a year to try to get them.
Okay, that was my question, was because you had not met any of it, and that's why I was concerned about that. Okay, thank you.
That's a very high standard. It's basically, in many areas, they would be called a diabetic specialist by meeting all these standards. And so CHC has another 12 months to do it.
Thanks for reminding me.
Any further questions from commissioners? Any questions from the public? No. All right, then.
Thank you.
We will thank you very much for bringing us this report, and we will now be in recess for a short break. Department report, Dr. Thomas.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Entz. A number of issues to report on today. We have included the press release on influenza. There are 8 confirmed cases of influenza in San Luis Obispo County as of this date. As I'm sure you're aware, flu vaccine is the supply is late again. This is like 4 years in a row that the flu vaccine is a problem. We did hold clinics October 28th in multiple sites, and that was late in the year. We had scheduled it later than the state and the Centers for Disease Control recommended, so that physicians could provide their most high-risk patients first, so those people would get taken care of, we would see the ones who didn't have physicians with flu vaccine or those that weren't tied to a primary care provider. However, many physicians in the area have not received their vaccine as of yet. We're getting ready to send out a survey. We've talked to quite a few physicians. There are a number of pharmacies that were expecting vaccine, and their order has been canceled from the supplier they were expecting to get it from because of some of the Chiron vaccine is late or not being shipped. So I want to emphasize it is not too late to get a flu vaccine in late November or early December. That is the main message we need to get across is don't panic, get a flu shot when it becomes available. The total amount expected in the United States is still expected to be between 78 and 81 million doses, which is the highest number available any year in the past. So it's somewhat late, but better late than never, I suppose. So, however, there are people who are pushing at the federal, state and federal level. It is a federal issue because federal the vaccine supply is a private industry situation, and there are, the manufacturers and suppliers are not even willing to share specific information about where their vaccine has gone, who's ordered it, and where it's gone because it's considered to be proprietary information. And so that puts us at somewhat of a disadvantage because the physicians last year said, stop. We surveyed them something like 12 times during the flu season about flu vaccine, and we're not going to do it more than once or twice this year because you surveyed too many times and they stop answering your questions. We did have a disaster drill last week. It was called NOVEX, November exercise. We had a number of organizations involved, including the National Guard Civil Support Team. So it's always interesting to work with a federal resource, federal government interacting with the state, interacting with the county. And it's always a learning experience. And it's too bad they didn't do it more often in New Orleans before they had their big event. If anybody would like a copy, we can send you the link for the HHS, Health and Human Services, Pandemic Influenza Plan. It's big. There's a lot of work to do, and we are meeting on a weekly basis to update our plan and get a lot of other players involved. That would include, obviously, county government in terms of businesses in a pandemic situation being able to continue their business, in terms of hospitals being able to increase their capacity and in surge capacity. Working with first responders, working with the business groups, and working among ourselves to provide increased surveillance and an ability to, if we happen to have one of those situations where we had a first case, we would be able to jump on it and provide antivirals and vaccine if it was available at that time. There is a question.
Dr. Thomas, do you think it's appropriate to do a presentation to the Health Commission so the general public would have a better idea what the county's plan is?
Sure. We're working. We'll do that in the next couple of months. I want to emphasize at this point that avian flu is what has everybody concerned with, and avian flu is just that, is H5N1. It's a flu that affects chickens and birds. Humans, if they get into very, very close contact with chickens or ducks or other birds that are infected, if you look at societal practices, how close humans and chickens exist in a number of the Asian countries compared to the United States, it's really a hugely different situation. So unless there is a mutation of the virus, we may, it's theoretically possible that sometime in the next year or two or three we could have affected poultry in this country, but unless there's a mutation, it shouldn't be a problem for humans. And even an infected chicken, if it's cooked, as long as you don't get any raw chicken blood or chicken feces, it isn't transmissible to humans. Let's see. Pertussis, we have 94 cases meeting laboratory or clinical criteria reported since August. We do appear to have a diminishing number of reports. I will keep my fingers crossed. We've been working to get them people isolated out of school and treated before they can go back to school so that they don't give pertussis to other classmates or people they're in contact with. Medi-Cal managed care. Oh, I would also like to say pertussis is also being seen in a number of other Central California counties and Northern California counties. This is not a isolated spot in California.
Can I ask a question?
Certainly.
Are these youngsters who've never been immunized, or are the youngsters who were immunized different?
The question was whether these people were once immunized, and it's a failure of long-term immunity, or are they those who were never immunized?
It's both. The problem is people who were immunized as children, and now they're adolescents, and their immunity has waned, or they're adults who were vaccinated as children and don't have immunity, or some of them are people whose parents did not want to get their children vaccinated. It's certainly a reason to push vaccination for the acellular pertussis vaccine in children, and also there's a new vaccine for adolescents and adults that's new on the market, actually, as of last August, which is somewhat increasingly available.
Will that become a routine for, say, youngsters at the high school age?
I expect so, over time. And so hopefully it'll limit some of these future pertussis outbreaks. So we did the presentation on Medi-Cal managed care to the Board of Supervisors. They told us to keep going forward, get more information, look at the Santa Cruz Monterey plan versus Santa Barbara Regional Health Authority. We are holding some community group focus groups at CHC, at the Head Start Parents Council, Adult Services Policy Council, and we'll go back to the Board of Supervisors on December 13th, I believe.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Did I understand you correctly that the supervisor said you should work with Monterey and North County rather than Santa Barbara?
No, they said we endorse this county organized health system concept. Mm-hmm. Go forth and have some further discussions with both Santa Cruz and Monterey system and Santa Barbara.
Okay, I misunderstood you then. Thank you.
Yeah. There have been a number of discussions with the executive director in the Santa Cruz Monterey area, and frankly, Santa Barbara seems to be more interested in a merger than Santa Cruz Monterey. And the Mental Health Services Act, there's a summary in your handout. And the draft plan is available at www.opinionstudies.com. So you can look at the long version or the short version and give your input. And the public is also encouraged to go to www.opinionstudies.com and look for MHSA, Mental Health Services Act. A couple of other points. I'd like to. I did some research on the E. coli experiment, where high school students are sticking an ampicillin resistant gene. And a couple of different microbiologists from the Department of Health Services wrote back. The prototype E. coli that's being used has numerous mutations built into them, for example, that makes them unable to synthesize key amino acids. This prevents them from either causing infections in hosts or dissemination in the environment. Their viability exists only in vitro in extremely nutrient-rich situations. These are common exercises work carried out at many schools, essentially mutated strains for use in a laboratory situation are class one pathogens and can be worked on at a benchtop without a hood. This is a different form of a mutation that is caused, and the strain is ineffective in surviving outside the laboratory and specifically unable to colonize the gastrointestinal tract, and therefore would not pose a risk unless inoculated directly into the eye or a open wound. So that's basically, it's a very specialized strain that they use for this kind of experiment. But still, it's very appropriate to you for the students to be taught how to deal with this kind of situation. And I've had a fascinating time getting this information, searching the internet and talking with teachers. There was a meeting with the CEOs of the hospitals about the dental surgery access. It looks like we're going to be able to work out significant improvement over the next several weeks, and so I'm hopeful on that area. And that's the end of my report, unless there are questions.
Commissioner Hale.
I was going to say, with regard to the dental issue, the very last issue you mentioned, when I was looking through the minutes and looking at the figure that Dr. Keller brought of something like $800,000 lost in providing that service, I mean, part of my question was, how do they know what the actual cost is or what the actual loss is? You know, where do figures like that come from?
There is a debate because a number of the dentists are bringing information forward claiming that the average reimbursement when you include all the Medi-Cal patients with the private pay patients, that when they average it, the average reimbursement is $2,400 a patient. I think one of the dentists may have said that last month. And they've got dueling statistics, and so there are patients. Everybody acknowledges that a Medi-Cal patient currently without a separate condition that would require hospitalization, Medi-Cal is not paying for those, and they're only paying for the medical supplies, the anesthesia supplies, and that's around $71 total. So whether it costs the hospital $500, $600 to do a case in the operating room that takes an hour and a half or 2 hours, that's my gut feeling, but I don't have any. That's kind of coming out of increasing for inflation figures that I was given 4 or 5 years ago.
Were there any other questions? Commissioner Hetherington?
I wanted to ask Dr. Thomas to make sure that Teresa Campbell got that information that you presented on the schools.
Does she have an email, do you know?
I'll send it to you tomorrow.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much, Dr. Thomas. We'll move along then to our Health Commission updates. The chair's update is that I attended the Bioterrorism Preparedness Advisory Committee meeting on the 3rd. The subjects were much of the same on Dr. Thomas's report, talking about the Novex and pandemic flu preparedness. And then there was an update on the BT and HRSA grants. Basically, at this point, previous grants, they've been getting the equipment. Now the focus is on the plans and procedures and training and exercises. And that's about it for me. So let's start at your end, Commissioner Hetherington.
Well, I had some delightful conversations with the media, trying to get some focus on the commission's activities. But as you can see, it wasn't very fruitful. So I guess perseverance is the key. Boy, I'm backwards. That was my committee report. So you've already gotten that one. And I have nothing to report on activities. I'm unable to do the slow cap. So if somebody else wants to pick that up, they meet the Monday that we have the Health Commission at 8:30 at DHS. And I'll be happy to put you in contact with Roberta.
Is there anyone who would like to be the slow cap? Wasn't Penny? I thought Penny was going to try and go. But I'm not sure about that. So we'll check. Stay tuned. Okay, Commissioner Massey. Commissioner Horn.
Last time I had gone to Children's Network Services, and I forgot all my belongings in the car. Anyway, so I brought them this time. And the one thing that really stuck in my mind was the Community Counseling Center, which does community counseling for children and adults, and as a United Way organization, is now doing things in Spanish. And so I thought that was something that probably is a plus that's coming into being. So I have these things that people would like to send them out.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Commissioner Hicks?
I think it's the 18th, which I believe is Thursday. There is a SART meeting scheduled, and I will be attending it unless my schedule prevents me from doing so. So I have no report.
Thank you. Commissioner Hale?
Well, the public health grant and community-based organization grant process is gearing up again, and unfortunately I missed the first meeting that was actually revising the request for proposal form, but that's gearing up. I got to enjoy some of the Novex drill activity, and I thought actually things went pretty well, and I was positively impressed.
There just weren't enough victims. They were expecting 1,000, and I think they got 60 because it rained, and what they planned to get didn't come through.
I think there were enough, though, that did demonstrate that you can overwhelm the system pretty easily. I'm also involved in some physician recruitment activities right now, as well as the latest with regard to our closure of our helicopter landing pads. There's a lot going on in the county right now.
Thank you. Commissioner Donnelly?
I have nothing to report.
Commissioner Warren?
Yes, I attended the Drug and Alcohol Advisory Board meeting, and it was very well attended, and they had a great presentation that Jan Campbell did and showed the video, The Listening Heart, and talked about Dr. Chasnoff's studies, and he will be here again in December, I think speaking to Children's Services Network, and he'll be here for 3 days. So unfortunately, the statistics aren't getting a lot better, so it'll be interesting to see what comes of that. And this, I was real impressed because the board members on the advisory board had a lot of questions and seemed to take that to heart. So hopefully they'll have some suggestions, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Pinkle? Thank you. Nothing to report. All right. Prospective future items. Next month we'll be seeing our nonprofits committee reports. Well, let's do committee reports. Legislative committee
We did not meet this month.
Oh.
Yeah.
And nominating committee?
Nominating committee did not meet this month.
And you gave your community education report already?
But let me plant a seed, because Public Health Month will be here sooner than we know it. And so I beg the commissioners to start thinking of activities that the commission can take part in as part of Public Health Month.
It's March. April. When is Public Health Month?
April.
And did the Budget Committee meet?
No, the Budget Committee did not meet. We're waiting. We're on hold.
Okay. All right. Now I'm back on track. Next month we will have the nonprofits coming to make their presentation, which is our traditional December meeting. And are there any other items that commissioners wish to speak on or comment on?
I've got a question. We are, I think, scheduled to have three more members of our task force, and when are we going to have a meeting to look at the applications for those three positions?
The process, as I understand, is we have made that information public, that we are looking for those, for the, actually the bioethicist and the biomedical researcher. And the deadline for those applications at this point is the 23rd of November. When, assuming applications come in, when that deadline then comes up, then the committee, of which you are a member, will meet and discuss the applications and interview, I presume, interview the applicants.
Right.
And I think there is someone from the Public Health Department. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, someone has notified me they're going to turn in an application.
Okay.
And I guess that really is a question. Does the commission, the way that the motion came out last month, it appeared that public health professional was being looked for whether it was a public health department employee or not, and that you would choose them as a member, or do you want a public health department staff member as a liaison to the committee?
Well, we originally had a public health department staff member as
right.
Serving as a liaison, I
right.
presume. So, and then that person wasn't able to come to the meeting, so we were lacking that particular expertise.
Right.
So
that's what you
my thought that. Was is that we needed to replace that person so that we did have that area of expertise
wasn't
there.
Totally clear from the motion last
well you're right it wasn't
yeah okay so there is a staff member who is interested in serving in that capacity. I will tell her she does not need to fill out a full application and be interviewed, therefore,
unless there are just a whole lot of public health people who are dying to be on this committee.
Maybe I will have her fill out an application, okay. then, if there's right. another public health person who
is. There's more than one person who's interested in doing that, then I think that probably then the committee, the selection committee, should then have an opportunity.
Very good.
To,
I agree.
Yeah. Okay.
We should be so lucky to have several applicants.
I have one candidate, as you know. I've sent
yes.
the application into you.
And I believe there's one other person who has received an application. I don't know if they've turned it in yet. Or not. So it's been moved and seconded that we adjourn. Any objections? This meeting is in adjournment.